A little bit of Hecate in my life. A little bit of Circe by my side. A little bit of Athena's all I need. Why am I singing? Who can tell? We're talking about absolute Wonder Woman. Hello, everybody, and welcome back to your new favorite show, a show that I will not apologize for. My name is Drew, and we are here to continue Absolute August, and we are covering this week Absolute Wonder Woman issues 1-7. But I need the skeletal horse to my arm that disappears. Miles, how are you, my friend?
I was doing fine until that musical number you came up with, which I don't know why Mambo number 5 keeps coming up for me this week, and I don't understand it.
That's weird. That's very strange. I literally thought of it just the second before I clicked record, which is why we had to do it twice. But you don't know that, so.
Well, like, because the story, it's made the rounds before, but there was a time where Stephen King was going through some writer's block or something, and one of the things that helped him get out of it was continually listening to Mambo Number 5, which was a song he loved at the time. And
that's really, really, really strange.
The way he tells the story is that Tabitha King, his wife, threatened to leave him if he played the song once more because she was sick and tired of it. His wife of like 50 years was like, no more.
Oh, man. Well, we are here, gang, to talk about Absolute Wonder Woman, which is the second of the Absolute heroes that we were covering. Not only two. We covered Batman a couple weeks ago. Then we took a little break for me to have a birthday challenge where we talked about Clear Obscure Expedition 33. But now we are back with friend of the show, Kelly Thompson's new award-winning book. Or at least award-nominated book. I don't know if the awards have happened yet.
I believe they have. I think she won. If I'm not mistaken. It won Best New Series and Best Coloring.
At the Eisner
Awards. And then she personally was nominated for Best Writer. Hayden Sherman was nominated for Best Cover Artist. And Becca Carey was nominated for Best Lettering. So I know it won... Which, I mean, technically, Kelly Thompson and I think it would have been Hayden Sherman. I think all three of them would have won for Best New Series. I think the author, colorist, and artist get the credit for that.
Well, it's a job well done in my book. It's just so funny to think that 10 years ago, I was sitting in this very basement interviewing Kelly Thompson about about different things, and now we are reading her work on one of the chief. I mean, she's done a lot of work since
the last time we talked to her, which when she was doing, I think, Hawkeye.
Yeah,
was the last time we were talking to her. No, she had just taken over Captain Marvel.
That was it.
And, the way you introduced that, I was like, wait, did she just surprise us and is all here tonight?
Yeah, sorry for that.
Which I'd love to talk to Kelly again. You know, I probably could have shot her via an email. But, huge, huge fan of her writing. And I know she had told us, I think off air, you know, that she really had aspired to write for DC. And... I know at the time it just wasn't quite happening, and I guess some.
I want to say she had like a pitch for a spoiler book of some kind, if I remember.
Yeah, it was right. Something because I know she did Birds of Prey before this, or is still doing Birds of Prey. I think she's doing. Yeah, she did Birds of Prey when it relaunched with the All In universe, I think. But. I know she had said, like, she's like, I'm not really sure what's going on there. I don't know if they just don't like me or what, which couldn't be the case because...
Well, they worked it out.
Yeah. Well, I was like, one, Kelly's an amazing writer. And, I mean, we have been champions of her work for, like, about a decade. the first thing we covered with her, I think, was a Dark Horse OGN that she did.
Heart-shaped box was
Heart-shaped box, yes. And then Gem, which I absolutely love, and she very kindly sent me a really nice limited hardcover like omnibus that she signed a while ago. I gotta find that package because I gotta figure out where it is. Yeah, but huge fan of her writing. And this is honestly a little, while it's a little different than the stuff that I have seen her do before in terms of like tone, outside of like maybe the post-apocalyptic Captain Marvel stories, it still retains kind of like her signature witticisms. And I'm so happy about that. Oh. Because there are moments here where like, everything's kind of very serious and dour, and then just a little moment comes through and I'm like, yeah, there's Kelly.
Yeah, and a lot of that in the early part of the book comes through the character Circe, but then of course as we see Diana emerge as Wonder Woman, I was gonna say punches up, but that's like that, I didn't want to make that a pun. So
no, I know what you meant.
Well, so let's talk about Absolute Wonder Woman. And as we talked a couple weeks ago, what the absolute line is it's basically stories about taking away one of the core parts of these DC characters, or one of the principal parts of these DC characters, but keeping their spirit and their essence alive.
Mm-hmm.
And while that seemed like maybe that would be a very tough task, as we saw with Absolute Batman a couple weeks ago, they took away the money, but they didn't take away the soul of Batman. He's still extremely motivated. He's still extremely intelligent. He's still, you know, out there trying to...
He's still Batman. Batman. All of them had like three lines. Like, I think with Batman, it was like, you know, no money, no mansion, and then like still blank or all blank. And this one was, I think, was it no island, no lasso, I think, and all blank. And then Superman's was like, was it no parents, no something else? So they take the Kents away from him. So like, it's an interesting thing because this is supposed to be kind of like a darker universe in a sense, but not like the Scott Snyder metal dark universe, but just a kind of a hidden universe that Darkseid has been able to influence, where the natural inclination for the kind of course of things is to let evil kind of triumph a bit. And the cool thought experiment was, well, what happens when you have some of the most iconic heroes in the history of modern storytelling that we have come to know and love? Well, what happens when they're in this and we take some of the things that have been, you know, kind of attached to them for over 100 years? And like you said, keep the core of what makes the character great. I think it's a great experiment. And I have to say, just, you know, spoiler warning, so far, they're kind of knocking this out of the park.
So let's talk about Diana. So this is where I will say Wonder Woman's backstory is one that I know a bit of, but I don't know a ton. I know a bit of her original origin, but I don't know a ton of her rogues gallery, her stories, other than to say that I know that the character that we meet that will raise Diana is one of her biggest bad guys.
So that, similar with how Batman's best friends are his rogues gallery in the regular universe, I do love how a, you know, kind of perennial villain in regular comics is switched out with Hippolyta. She is now the mother figure and a phenomenal character in her own right.
Oh,
I think it's some of the best writing that she's ever received.
I think so, because they let her be, you know, a person. They let her, you know.
Mm-hmm.
And so instead of Wonder Woman growing up on the Amazonian island of Themyscira, being raised by her mother and all the other Amazons to be this hero, she is raised in hell, but it's like a Greek hell.
Yeah, this is still Greek myth, so it's not the Judeo-Christian idea with, you know, flames and a little guy with a pitchfork and, you know, horns. This is much more. It's a barren island in the underworld.
That is also full of creatures that want to kill them.
Yes.
And we know that, we of course know that Diana is an Amazon. We are potentially told that she is the last Amazon, but the word Amazon is like banished from being able to be spoken by Circe.
Which is a very, very cool idea.
There is a lot of really cool stuff when it comes to that. And there's a lot of stuff that they set up that we just really have no idea what's going on. There are future prophecies. There are, you know, weird versions of Greek gods. There's a whole bunch of stuff in this. And I want to give huge credit to the letterer of this book that I needed to actually look up, because...
Beckham Carey.
Because the way they have, you know, it's very common for like text bubbles to be color coded and font choiced for different characters and all that. It's still great here. But when they use the spells, and the spells are a combination of Cyrillic text and backwards Latin text, but it's all kind of like weirdly like wavy and thinned out, like it's just like it's got like the words have power. It's a very, very cool thing to see.
Yes,
on the page, it works really well.
Yeah, this is a situation where, you know, everyone is firing all cylinders. The art is serving the story very, very well, because it's not an art style that I would typically gravitate to if I was just like kind of flipping through some books. But the more you get into it, the more I think it's the right look for the book. Even though we get two issues of like just supremely gorgeous, like painted artwork that I was like, ooh, I love this too.
Yeah.
Because it's really, really good. But I do like the look of the book. And it does employ, and I wonder if, I don't know if it was an edict or if everyone just kind of agreed, this is probably the best way to tell the stories of at least the two of the Trinity that we've seen so far, is we are getting a current story running parallel with, to kind of catch us up with how we got here. So we're getting the origins kind of at the same time.
I mean, Absolute Batman did that too. I wonder if that's an editorial choice.
We'll find out next week if that's the case with Superman. And the 2-page splash or 3-page splash they gave us for the Flash on one of these issues did not really illuminate anything there.
I didn't see that splash, so that's interesting.
Oh yeah, in one of the issues it had a preview for Absolute Flash number one.
I did, however, and we're gonna have to have a slightly separate conversation about this after we wrap up our main discussion. You have Dustin Nguyen back for
Little Dianas.
Which is great.
Because I know you read the Little Batman stuff.
I did.
Back
I read
in the
a lot
day.
Of it. I didn't read all of it, but
it's very fun, and I'm glad they're letting, because Dustin Nguyen is known for some of his most gorgeous like watercolor inspired artwork you'll see in comics ever, but he also does like, he gets his little Scotty Young on and does these amazing little versions, these kid kind of versions of these characters, and so they allowed him to do these like little. One page little mini origins of different moments from Diana being a very young child. And it is precious.
It's adorable. It's so much fun. And it really, it's one of those things where, again, we talked about this with Absolute Batman, but the easy choice for all of these characters is, oh, they didn't have the comfortable childhood that they had. So now they're like, badass and dark and gloomy and da 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 da. No, Diana.
And you literally had Diana raised in hell,
and she is talking to animals, and she's she's apologizing,
making best friends with all these horrific creatures. And
it's so much fun. And I love the little stuff, and that's all like could be canon accurate to the actual main book because of how it ties in. It's just so much mm-hmm. fun. So yeah, so we have sort of our backstory, which is, it doesn't play out as well as, you know, it doesn't play out as much as the Batman one does, mostly because it's kind of shorter because they're doing more setup than they are explaining of things. Like,
well, yeah, this is a much less of a talky book than Absolute Batman was. There's a lot more chitter chatter in that book. And this one is, you know, the there is talking, obviously, but it's, the pacing is a lot faster.
Yeah. It's a faster read than Absolute Batman for
sure. Oh, these issues fly by. It reminds me of reading Ultimate Spider-Man back in the day when Bendis wrote that. Cause I mean, I feel like I turned a page and the thing was over. Yeah. And I'd always have to count the pages. I'm like, was this 10 pages? No, it was full 22. What I really do enjoy about this book is, because like you, I have experience with Wonder Woman. I actually have a Wonder Woman omnibus behind me, the Phil Jimenez one, because there's a run that this one has that hasn't really been collected since it came out, called Gods of Gotham, where the Wonder family and the Bat family team up because several evil Greek gods possess the villains of Gotham. And it is great. Covers by Adam Hughes, and it's so good. But well, I mean, you know, we've all seen the Wonder Woman movie, which is not too far in terms of like how Diana was raised. So there's some familiarity I have, but I don't know the deep lore. I know, yeah. I know stuff from the 90s and some stuff onward, but unlike Batman, which I have a granular understanding of the character and every aspect of, you know, every rock in Gotham. I kind of appreciated this a little more because it felt like such a different twist and taking, like an Absolute Batman, but to a more, I would say a larger degree, where Cersei has been a villain almost her entire comic book history and technically in parts of the Greek histories too.
Sure.
Like, she's the one that turns like all the soldiers and the pigs in the Odyssey. And so to take that character and to deconstruct that character of like, okay, what does motivate this person? And then to put them in a situation where they do have, like they worship Hecate and find out that, yes, yeah, I guess you could say they're aligned with darkness a little bit, but they have a light vision and they have this vision of the future for this child that they are bequeathed, for lack of a better term, and she becomes she becomes her mother. And I found all of the origin stuff, one, so moving, because this is a character, and that's a huge point for a lot of Diana's understanding of her adolescence, is at every turn Hecate should be a villain. She should be angry. At one point she's like, yeah, I'm gonna just let this baby die. You know, until she sees, mimicking the infancy of Hercules, where this giant serpent comes up to bite her, and she just whips that thing around like it's a lasso itself. And I think some of the most beautiful storytelling aspects is the relationship between Diana and Cersei, and how they continue to understand what the other has been saying their entire lives. I think it's one of the most beautiful things about this book.
Yeah. And it's weird to see this Wonder Woman that is instead of her normal blue and red and gold, it's still a lot of red, but there's a lot of blacks and silvers in the design. It's sort of like,
It's a lot of fun when you're not like being shackled by American patriotism in the 40s. Right.
But she looks like a like, you look at this and you think this is going to be evil Wonder Woman, but she definitely isn't. And that's where we should probably also talk about your boy Steve Trevor still somehow washing up on this island.
I love how they don't even explain why he's there. He is just there. And you know, they're both trying to figure out, like, is this a test? Is this, you know, a trial? Is this a trick? Is this a trap? What, who is this man? You know, and they do Steve Trevor justice. Like he is, they write him as if he's Captain America in terms of how he behaves, yeah. which I very much love. And I love that the clear attraction between the two of them is very subtle. It's not googly eyes. It's not, but there is a clear thing that Cersei clearly sees. She's like, oh, that boy gonna be trouble. But it's not an overdone thing. There is so much subtle writing here that it just doesn't beat you over the head, but you can pick up on it. And I love that Steve Trevor is like, I know he rescues her, I mean, she rescues him twice, but like he is like dyed in the wool, like, yeah, that's my homegirl right there. I'm going to stick up for her. I don't care who says nothing. Well, you know?
And it's because of some stuff we find out in the present day story that while all this is going on in the past, in the present, you have basically, who was it that is, I think he's a known guy. Who's the news reporter that's covering things?
Alan something.
It seemed like a familiar name, but I could just be pulling that out. But
I'm blanking if there is one.
And the other side of this is that a lot of stuff happens in this book, but we don't really get a reason why this early. And unlike the original, unlike the absolute Batman arc that was 6 issues, this is 5 and then a 2-issue mini arc that covers another very interesting story. But
I love that story so much. And it really hammers home what I was talking about. Like it gives you that kind of almost like an epilogue to kind of cement what I was talking about with the relationship between Wonder Woman or Diana and Cersei.
Yeah. So the Gateway City, Gateway City. Yes, I'm right.
Yeah, Gateway City.
Sorry. is under attack by this weird monolith that comes out of the ocean that all of these sort of red flying monster creatures start coming out. And luckily on the scene for the very first time is Diana, Princess of Hell, which is a great...
It's so good. I was like, yeah.
And her skeletal demon horse Pegasus.
Yeah, I mean the thing is like it's like Kelly saw that Scott Snyder wrote a book called Heavy Metal starring Diana and just went like, hold my beer.
Yeah.
Because all of this is metal as hell. Like she's the Princess of Hell riding a fire-breathing skeletal Pegasus. Fighting monsters with a giant sword. Like, this should be a Meatloaf album cover.
I'm sorry, Miles. She's not just fighting monsters with a giant sword. She's fighting monsters with the freaking Buster Sword from Final Fantasy VII.
Oh, it is 100% the Buster Sword. I thought the same thing. 1,000% yes. Like, this is so good. And it really, this kind of stuff is great because... it highlights the fantasy aspect of Wonder Woman and what separates Wonder Woman as a character from Superman and Batman. I think people do sometimes lose sight of that. Like they might use, you know, oh yeah, we'll have this Greek character as the villain, but they kind of lose sight of the myth and magic part sometimes and get more in the soap opera aspect of Greek myths. That certainly happened to like Cass a lot and Donna Troy, but I really love that this feels wholly different than Absolute Batman. Does it feel like it takes place in the same universe? Kind of, but it reminds me of back when you and I were kids, when you read a Superman book or a Wonder Woman book or X-Men, they all felt like they were part of their own little universe. So that if they do meet up with Superman for an issue or a special, it's a big deal. And I like the idea of kind of maybe defining the borders between these characters a little bit more. I think we've gotten a little too much shared universe-y. Like, I love a good shared universe, but I think sometimes it distracts from, hey, you know what? I just want to read a good Batman story, and now I have to read, you know, Superboy 17 to figure out what this one conversation's about. You know?
Yeah. But this also goes to the changes that they have made for Diana herself, in that she still has the ability to fly. She still has her super strength and all of that. But now she's also got magic. A ton of cool
magic. And like three lassos. No truth.
No lasso of truth, but like a lasso of pain, a lasso of suffering, and a lasso.
But as metal and evil as these things sound, it's like, no. It's a lasso of suffering because it's all the suffering that you have wrought upon other people. You have to feel tenfold.
Yes. And that's one of those things where it's like, if you wrap that lasso around a kind and good-hearted person, which I'm sure they will do at some point in the story, and it doesn't hurt them at all, it's going to be like, oh, that's so rad.
You know it. You know she's going to do that to Cal. 100% is going to do it to Wonder Woman. He's like, what's this? What's this string? Get it off. But she wraps around the harbinger of death, who has killed feasibly millions or billions of people throughout its existence. And there's a lot of feeling there.
And it starts begging for her to stop. And it's like, that's so rad.
Yeah, and this monster is like a kaiju-sized thing. It is not a small, well, like,
it's it a mini, looks, it's it, a mini kaiju, and then we get the other monster that's a full kaiju.
It's still kaiju-sized. The thing that comes after is like...
It's 30s King Kong-sized.
Yeah, a little bigger than... I would say maybe 50s Godzilla-sized. And before they gave King Kong a boost. Like, it's still the size of a building, but yes, the creature that comes after, the creature that it was the harbinger for, is more like current Godzilla and Kong size.
Yeah. Which, we gotta talk about this crazy creature called the Tetracide.
Yeah. Very Lovecraftian. It's like, tentacle-like, it felt like intestines just kind of hanging from its belly.
Yeah, it was like all like sticking out and going through. But the way that it is described is that its power and horror comes in four phases. And the first one is
sound,
the lack of horror, because the second one's the death of
fear, the death of the body, the death of the soul. There's another one. Between the two, there's four. It comes in four. Death of fear.
Because it's tetracide. Of course, it's four.
Yeah, it's death of fear because you when it makes the kind of its death call, it causes people to come to it.
Yeah,
maybe it's death of feeling because if you touch it, it can disintegrate you or something.
I don't remember.
Or disintegrate your mind. I can't remember.
I don't know. If you want to know what it is, go read the book.
Yeah,
But it's such an interesting like thing that it emits this call miles wide that will force people to march towards their doom to it. And it's like, how are we going to deal with this? How are we going to deal with this? And she finally figures out, oh, I'll just make everybody deaf.
So good. And she finds the camera guy, the news crew, and says, hey, need your help for a second. And basically makes a plea for them to keep it on loop and just say, hey, this is very, very scary. I am going to help you, but I need you to do these things for me. And this is what I'm going to do. You are going to go deaf for a very short time. And like kind of explains everything she's going to do very clearly. You don't see that a lot in superhero stories.
Yeah.
You often see the superhero acting and then explaining later. She's telling everyone exactly what's going to happen and then does it. And it's great. And then we start getting some of our, what I assume will be recurring supporting characters to appear.
Yeah, we have the new version of Etta Candy that shows up, who is...
Loved her.
She was great. And she and her sister, who are both witches in their own right.
I also love how she was continually complimenting on their store and what supplies they had. Like, Diana was just like, oh, this is perfect. No. Oh, I can't believe you have this. You guys are great. Yeah. Like, it was, you know, so
this
good.
This stuff is so hard to get in hell, but you it was really fun.
But you have it by the bushel here.
It was also really fun to see her interact with the military guys, who the one sort of leader of them in the meantime is like, well, bloody no, what are you doing here? And she just snaps back at him in like the kindest but firmest way.
Well, like, and it's so funny because like the initial like shot you get is like, you know, the first panel is him just yelling, and then you see the cutaway where he is like 2 feet smaller than her. And I thought it was Cotton Hill from King of the Hill. Because that's what he reminded me of, was Cotton. You see these babies? But no, I love that. And then you get to meet Barbara.
Who? Is that Cheetah?
I believe it is, if I'm not mistaken. Because I believe that's how they kind of, I mean, because it's also in the same in the, you know, the movie, Barbara Minerva. Yeah.
Yeah.
That is Cheetah.
And who ends up giving her the title of Wonder Woman because she wrote her doctoral thesis on the Amazons. And, you know, that's going to come back into play because, again, we don't know where the Amazons are, if the Amazons still are. We know that Diana defeats the bad guys and defeats the Tetracide in a very cool way, which is also awesome. But we don't know who sent them.
I have a feeling. I think I do.
You think it was Zeus?
No.
You think it's Zeus?
Unless they change things, it could be Zeus. If it's Zeus, I would be super excited because every time some shenanigans happens with the Wonder Family, there is only one god always behind it. And it's just typical with Cassie, and that's Ares. Ares is always the one causing a problem. Hell, I think he's the one causing the problem in the movie.
He is. Yeah, he's definitely the one causing the problem in the movie.
So, now, if it's Zeus, because this version of these gods certainly a little bit different, I will be really excited. If it's Ares, I won't be upset, but I'll be like, okay, that's about right. But that's who I think it was. Is our I think it's either or. I think if Kelly wants to give us a real twist, she's going to make it Zeus. But if she's going to be like, no, we still have to have a couple things be kind of, you know, the way they were.
I just know they have yet to really name check Ares in these issues.
They haven't, but that helmet she's got is very Ares looking.
Yeah, it definitely was. And it's one that I don't know where it came from because it seemed to just appear.
They don't name it at all. Which is, and that's the thing, is there is some mystery about Diana's destiny because it's been talked about, but it's still, even when the gods talk, even Hecate talks about it, and that's a Greek goddess that I'd never know if I am pronouncing it correctly.
I think I believe it is Hecate.
Okay. It still feels like she's talking about her hushed. Even there's a communique between her and Cersei where she's like, I have seconds and we're being listened to. And I'm like, ooh, boy. Because there is still a lot of mystery because we don't know where some of the stuff that she has came from. We don't know. I mean, Cersei could have easily been a villain before we met her.
And while she's been condemned to hell, she's done something.
Yes, but we've also seen that these gods are D-bags, so it could be anything. I
mean, also true. But it is also one of those things where it's almost like, you know, we talk about Cersei as a villain, and we talk about how Diana is this sort of pure soul who seems to bring out the best in people. And does
And Cersei keeps saying that that love is what changes people.
And does that to Cersei herself. And we see that change happen in this book. And it's just so
it's phenomenal writing. I mean, again, I don't want to sound flippant, but I can't say I'm surprised because I've been such a fan of Kelly Thompson's character writing.
Of course.
I mean, no, because I was a big flag waver for her Gem book. I, to this day, still, it's one of my favorite, like, cartoon adaptation attempts. Like reboots, it's so good, and you know, seeing her work in Marvel, I knew what she's capable of, but getting to helm a massive Wonder Woman relaunch, and because I mean they put a lot of mustard behind this absolute launch. It's this is gonna sound weird, but like I just feel so like proud of like our friend, like. Because, I mean, we when we met her, she was just, you know, she was a writer who was cutting her teeth on the indies, and she, you know, paid her dues and everything. But it's so cool to know how good somebody is and to see the right people recognize it. Absolutely. And to also see her just knock it out of the park. Because she apps, I mean, this thing is paced beautifully. She balances the past and present so well. She establishes some mysteries that really kind of, you know, pull at your you know, just nag at you. You're like, oh, I gotta find out, you know. And everything is just is well done. She's introducing characters in a way that like you are immediately drawn to who they are, and it doesn't matter that, oh yeah, that's the cheetah, or you know, oh, that's fan favorite character, you know. It doesn't matter, because they're everything's written so freshly with these kind of brand new eyes, and that is very difficult to do. And Snyder did it with Batman. Thompson is 100% doing it here with Wonder Woman, and we haven't even finished this story yet, because we do. Let's tell the folks at home how Diana takes care of this personification of death.
She effectively turns herself into a kaiju-sized Medusa and turns this thing to stone.
So good.
It's such a simple idea, but it's one that like you don't see it coming, and it's so fun. But it's also very interesting because she loses control after she turns herself into Medusa.
Mm-hmm.
And it's Steve Trevor who brings her back. We didn't even talk about her arm.
Oh yeah, we haven't. But oh, Steve Trevor, who's blindfolded and is just calling out Diana. It's so well done. And she's like, yeah, I knew you were the right person to do this.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
It's and you're like, oh, this is so sweet, but they don't linger on it. It's such smart writing. It's such smart writing. But yes, let's talk about Diana's arm.
Yeah, because when she's fighting the Tetricide grabs her arm, and in order to escape, she just sort of says one of these spells, and her arm disappears, and you see like a shoulder stump where it was before. And when this is intercut with the past, when Steve was on Hell with her and Circe, that Diana figures out a way to send him back, and it's with the blood of a hero, with the blood of a warrior. And she cuts off her own arm and sacrifices it in order to send Steve Trevor back to his world. And it is what, and in that moment, I also love right before it happens, the evening before it happens, because it happens at night. She asks, Circe asks Steve to go get some firewood from the front hall, and he's like, and he comes back, he's like, thank you for allowing me to do this by myself. Maybe one day I'll get to leave the house by myself. Like, it's just some funny thing that happens there, but yeah, and because again, there's another side of this that we have to talk about, because we talked about how we don't know how Steve got to Hell. We now know that Diana made a huge sacrifice in order to get him out of there. But at this point in the book, we don't know how she left. And that's another big mystery.
And it's brought up in the next two-part story, but not answered.
But not answered. So yeah, this is interesting. That so we've got The Last Amazon, which is issues 1-5, and now we can move on to The Lady or the Tiger, which is just a little two issue. It almost felt like a sub story to stay on time for some things, but it's so important to the overall story that it can't be. But they have a different artist on these two issues, and the art in this is different, but also incredible.
Oh, so good. I also, I want to see if I can have Kelly back on, because I gotta ask her if it was her idea, which it wouldn't shock me if it was, or if it was the artist's idea, because Hades is clearly inspired by Disney's Hercules Hades.
As a lot of them are now, which is...
I love that so much, because he even kind of acts like him. That's why I think it was probably Kelly's idea, because he has that vibe to him, and he's blue and, like, living flame. Very, very fun. It just cracked me up. Also, it's worse. It's where a lot more sass comes out in this book. There's a lot more of that standard Kelly sass in here, and I'm here for it.
Coming out of Hades is all over the place, but
coming out of Hades. But also, he even comments and like the lip on these women that I've sentenced to hell.
Yeah, it's like you have your mother's tongue or something.
Sharp
like
tongue.
That. Yeah.
It's so good, but I love the bit. Like, this is another one where you have, you know, some past and present coinciding, but I love the twist on the classic Hades story and the inclusion of someone who we don't get to see a lot of these stories, Persephone.
Which I love the story of Persephone. I don't love the story of Persephone.
I was gonna say, I know what you're trying to say, but.
I'm a big
fan of the kidnapping.
Yeah, I'm interested in the story of Persephone, how it played.
No, it's a classic myth. Yeah,
how it played out in the myths and how it has been reinterpreted in different ways in modern media, including the video game Hades, which that story factors quite a bit as well. But
get them good bonuses.
But with this, you have,
which happens here. Actually, I'm. Now that you said that, and looking at her design,
her design's pretty different.
It's different, but green.
Oh, Persephone
isn't she green in Hades?
No, I don't think so.
Who am I thinking of?
I think you're thinking of.
I'm thinking of Aphrodite, aren't I?
No, Aphrodite is pink. I think you might be thinking of Athena.
Oh, maybe I was. It's not important.
Well, so Persephone in Hades has a number of different looks, and I'm going to send you pictures after we're done recording, because it's one of my favorite character changes between scenes. It makes me very, I find it very funny. And I love it anyway. But yeah, we sort of have this childhood Diana talking with Persephone as she is wandering the underworld because she has to stay there for 1 month every year, as it goes with the classic stories. And it intercuts with this sort of prophecy that Hecate and Circe are talking about. And Hecate's like, I'm being watched, I can't tell you anymore. And a book appears, and it's a book. It's a story. And I don't know whether this is a real story or a story invented for this. I don't know enough about Greek mythology, and I don't know enough about Greek fables and things like that. The lady or the tiger. A princess falls in love with a commoner. The king hates the commoner, is in love with his daughter. So he condemns the commoner to go into the arena, and there's two doors, and behind one door is a tiger that will kill him, and behind the other door is a beautiful woman that he will spend the rest of his life with. And it's all very, you know, you'll be wonderful, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. But that woman is not his daughter. And so the princess decides that she is going to figure out which one is the safe door, the happiness door, and she's gonna tell him, she's gonna give him some sort of signal with that. But she also learns that the woman is a woman that the love of her life used to be in love with, and she's jealous of this girl. So as she makes a subtle nod to a door, that's when at the very end, that's when the story ends, and we don't know what door she's motioned to. And it's all about how Diana has a super hard time handling that there is no end to the story and she doesn't know how the story ends and all of this stuff, and how that comes back through as we see Cersei and Diana revisiting that storybook when she's a little kid and when she's a little older, and when she has this realization in her young adulthood about the story. It's just,
I'm not the princess. Oh, so good.
It's
so good.
It's so good.
And it's another shared moment between them, because when Cersei does the little head lift and gets freedom, but it's like, Persephone, your wife, happened to visit me a couple times, and I happened to consume a couple of these old pomegranate seeds.
Or Hades, your wife.
What did I say?
You said Persephone, your wife.
Yeah, Persephone, comma, your wife.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. And those grant a month's stay in the underworld. And I can come and go as I please. Now, they do, and I like how they, at the end of the story, Diana's flying. She doesn't land, because if she does land, she has to stay there for a month.
Yeah,
and she's got things to do. I love they're a stickler. They. I love that Kelly writes this as a stickler to the Greek myth. I think it's such a great touch. Like, rules are important in storytelling, and a lot of times people get loosey goosey just to throw the audience off, but it's just for that cheap pop. It's never for the betterment of the but it's often not for the betterment of the story. Now, having rules and following them, and having rules and not telling the audience, are two different things. There are movies that may not feel like they have rules, but like The Critic, I'm like, oh, there's rules, I just didn't tell you them. And that's also fine. But to have these defined things and have the characters have to follow them is just a great touch. And I truly loved this two-part story. I thought it was great. It's a little bit of an epilogue to the what we just had, but as this kind of opening salvo to this version of Wonder Woman, I think it's a masterstroke.
Absolutely. It's really, really, I've, as we talked about this at the start, Wonder Woman is a character that we both really like, but we don't spend a lot of time with, unlike characters like Batman and really even Superman, although I don't spend a ton of time with Superman stories either. We just happen to have spent a lot of time with Superman this summer.
I mean, I've certainly spent a good chunk of time with Superman stories. But yeah, Batman obviously is our, I mean, you know, I've got Batman and Robin tattoos. It's a Bat family member is one of my favorite fictional characters of all time, yeah. You know.
But I love this, and I love that it's really... It is a darker story, but it's still such a hopeful, proud story that I cannot wait to read more of this as well.
It almost feels like the antithesis of a grim, dark story, of a Snyder story. Like, because you have a character...
A Zack Snyder story, not a Scott Snyder story.
Correct. That important distinction. One fundamentally understands these characters and one does not. That you have, I think this is what makes the exercise work, is that you have these characters and this universe that should, in any other situation, create the characters you might see in, well, like the Dark Knight Returns universe or the Zack Snyder universe, these kind of grim, dark, muted tone versions of our heroes. And the exercise is such a smashing success, because it's not only that these characters are the beacons of light in these dark worlds, but they are doing so still in service to the world in which they exist. Like, it's not just, oh, it's this bright character and that's just who they are all the time. No, both Scott Snyder and Kelly Thompson and their incredible art and lettering team take great care to show the how and why these characters are the beacons of hope, are the standard for justice, even in the dark world that is influenced by an evil force. You cannot stop the spirit of Batman and Wonder Woman, and I'm assuming Superman. We'll see next week. I love that so much about this. I don't want to call it an experiment, because I know it's kind of, you know, their new imprint, but that, you know, I guess, like I said in the opening of the Batman episode, I was so hesitant about this because of the massive, like, turd the All-Star stuff was, barring All-Star Superman, which was, you know, Grant Morrison, Frank Quitely doing all-timer stuff, yes, as they do. but yeah, I mean, I'm not shocked that, oh, I loved a Kelly Thompson Wonder Woman book, but at the same time, I also love this completely amazing reinvention of the character that understands the heart and soul of what makes Wonder Woman such an immortal character. And I just think the entire team knocked it out of the park. Like, I'm so impressed by this book.
And that with all of this, they still included little Diana sub stories that are just so much fun.
They're so good. They're so good.
I love it, because it wouldn't fit in the Batman book. Would not fit in the Batman book at all.
No, not with the Batman story they're telling. But when you have, oh, little Diana can talk to creatures, and there's nothing but horrible creatures, well, guess what? Some of them become their friends.
No biting friends.
You can get bigger when you stop biting. Oh, it's so good. Yeah,
your head is now tiny until you stop biting friends.
It's so good.
So much fun. I love it.
Absolute treat. I got to say, a massive kudos to Kelly Thompson and the entire team. Which I gotta call out everybody. The artists, Hayden Sherman, Matilda DeLuise, if I'm saying that correctly, Dustin Nguyen, letterer, Becca Carey, colorist, Jordi Belair, and editor Chris Conroy. Incredible job, everybody. I mean this with the bottom of my heart. Everyone should be proud, just like the Bat team. Like, they have done incredible, I would say, character defining work here.
Yes. And it's one of those things that I worry that this absolute universe has like a time limit to it.
I feel like it has a shelf life, and maybe it should. We'll see.
Maybe it should, but they're kicking ass with this right now.
It drives home what I loved about some of the Elseworld stories back in the day. And because, like, you would take, I mean, yeah, sometimes it's fun. Like, hey, what if Batman fought Dracula or Jack the Ripper in this, you know, version of Gotham? But you also have, let's take this character that is in a safe space in terms of comics and put him somewhere else entirely. And let's see if we can create the spirit of that. And two of my favorite are actually technically Superman stories. One's a Batman Superman story, Superman Speeding Bullets, where they give Clark Kent Bruce Wayne's origin. And so he starts off as Batman and super angry, violent, and through the course of the story becomes Superman, and it's amazing. The other, which is my personal favorite Superman story of all time, Superman Secret Identity, which takes place in the real world, about a kid named Clark Kent who is constantly teased about his name. He's set up on a date with a Lois Lane. They both are like really irritated, but then they actually fall in love. The whole story is fantastic, and he's actually Superman. It's a phenomenal story. Kurt Busiek and Stuart Immonen, like two comic book greats, doing character-defining work. And I think that's when DC and comics in general shine the best, when you have these long-standing characters. It's when you take big swings, when you make memorable stories, and not just, oh, yeah, let's fill in 6 months of a Joker story, whatever, you know, or, hey, Killer Croc's back. Like, let's take time and create stories that mean something to people and mean something to these characters. And I think with the Absolute Universe, that's exactly what they're doing right now so far.
Well, with that said, let's not close the book on Absolute Wonder Woman, but let's open up another book as we talk about what will be, for at least this month, the last entry in Absolute August. And that is the first 6 issues of Absolute Superman. Yes, I know we've spent a lot of time on Superman this year, but we can't.
That's okay.
We can't talk about the big 3 DC characters without bringing the big blue Boy Scout back. But is he a big blue Boy Scout this time around? I don't know. I read the opening sentence of the summary of what this book is, and this seems pretty different. But I have a sneaking suspicion based on how Batman and Wonder Woman have gone. I think we're in for a fun time.
Yeah, if they can nail the trilogy, they can bork the other characters, which I know is right now absolute Martian Manhunter, absolute Flash, and absolute Green Lantern. Not saying they do. I'm just saying they can. But so long as the Trinity's intact, I'll be pretty happy. I'm excited to read Absolute Superman, especially after how phenomenal Batman and Wonder Woman have been. Before we say goodbye, we talked about this a couple days ago, and I think we should still talk about this. We got to say a little F you to a little C word this week.
Yeah, cancer, guys. Cancer sucks.
Cancer does suck. Those of you know, we have been watching what is becoming one of my favorite animes of all time, Macross 7. And one of the premier actresses in the show, voice actress Rurouni Kenshin, if I'm pronouncing that correctly.
No, Drew? The Rurouni Kenshin is a show she was on.
Sorry. Homura Sakurai. Yeah. I remember Rurouni Kenshin. I don't know why. My brain is so shot from the last like 2 weeks because I've also been dealing with, not for me, but family related cancer stuff. And so it's been a long week. But yeah, so she voices such a wonderful character in Macross 7, Mylene Genius, and unfortunately passed away this past week at the age of 53, with what I only saw as multiple organ cancer.
Which was like multiple organ cancer. God, that sucks.
Well, so it could have been a situation where like maybe there was a node on her liver and it spread or something like that.
It's tough to say, but 53 is so young.
It's so young. I mean, heck, we're not too far away from that age, you know.
Not anymore, no.
And we're still over 10 years away, but we're still, you know. But it. This is certainly a voice that has meant a lot to a lot of people, and certainly becoming a major voice for me as I'm making this journey through this 30-year-old genius show. But I wanted to spend some time because, you know, a lot of news about, you know, Japanese creators and actors and actresses, the news tends to be slow getting here. I mean, there's times where, like, you don't find out that someone passed until a month later. You know, in these situations. So finding out that this tremendous voice talent passed is... Yeah.
Apparently she passed the day after my birthday, which was, it's great. I love that. I don't.
Oh no. Yeah, that's right. The 13th. Sorry. I read the 17th and I was skipped over. She was supposed to be at a con on the 17th. But yeah, obviously I'm just talking about Macross 7, but yeah, she was in Rurouni Kenshin, she was in Saint Tail, Fatal Fury, Gale Force, Pokemon the Arceus Chronicles. She voices Shrona and Cynthia. And which I'm not familiar with the Arceus Chronicles. I've heard it's really good. And she also, you know, sang some of the songs in Macross 7.
Yeah, she has performed them. I don't think she has credits in the actual show itself for the music, but I don't know that for a fact. But
I just wanted to give it because Drew had brought this up and I was like, yeah, we should I agree with you, we should definitely give her a little, you know, RIP here. Just, you know, gone too soon. Incredible voice actress with a wonderful range, and she will definitely be missed. But I hate that we ended the episode on that note, but I wanted us to talk about it a little bit.
For sure. And we are going to continue, but though she is gone, we are going to continue to celebrate her as often as we can. Our Macro 7 watchings on Discord have slowed down a little bit just because
life gets in the way.
Life has gotten very busy, but after about 2 weeks, we're going to be back to hopefully weekly, and if not every other week, it's until we get to the end of the show, and then hopefully watch a little bit more, and hopefully watch some other stuff with you guys. And you might say, wait, Discord, you guys have a Discord? Well, we kind of do. So Well, you can find the two of us at themoreyounerd.com and a bunch of different social media networks where you can find us at themoreyounerd or /themoreyounerd or all of that. You can also email us themoreyounerd@gmail.com. That's themoreyounerd@gmail.com. But we have another show that we do with our friends called Cosmic Crit. Cosmic Crit is a show where we play the game Starfinder, and we are actually about to start a whole new arc of Starfinder, which is going to be very fun and very cool. And you can find that at CosmicCrit.com. Now, if you go to CosmicCrit.com, in the upper right-hand corner, there's a link to the Cosmic Crit Discord. That is where you can come and join and play your own games with people. We're about to kick off CritterCon in a few weeks, where we're going to be doing games all the time. Starfinder, Pathfinder, all sorts of different tabletop RPGs. It's a very fun time. Or you can just join the Discord and talk to me and Miles all day while we are. So that's it, gang. That's where we're going to end the show tonight. And now we end the show, as we always do, with a rousing
nerd out. Too nerd for y'all.